Our guest today for the full hour is, at least in my point of view, unquestionably one of the finest riders of naval history in the last half century, James D. Hornfisher. I kind of feel sheepish that we've had the show on for 20 months, and we haven't had him on yet, because whether it's over at my home blog, I believe over at Eagle One's as well, USNI blog, or even here on Midrats, a lot of the listeners have read his works, whether it's Ship of Ghosts about the USS Houston in the early months of the war, The Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailors, of course. And that part of the war always has a lot of lessons and brings a lot of conversation out. And a lot of that conversation is based upon the outstanding work that he's done. And we brought him on today to talk about not only those books we're familiar with, but he also has a new book out, Neptune's Inferno, the U.S. Navy at Guadalcanal. Jim, welcome to Midraps.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And by the way,
there's no problem, waiting 20 months to have me. I realize the guy's got to pay his dues, you know.
There's only one weekend a month, you know. What can you do? And we kind of talked about it a little bit on the pre-show, but one of the things I've really enjoyed about your books is the arc that your work has done, starting with Ship of Ghosts and USS Houston, as a member of the American, British, Dutch, and Australian ill-fated Asiatic fleet, the beginning of the war. Of course, Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailors. I'd love to see that in surround sound on the big screen. And finally, Neptune's Inferno, the U.S. Navy at Guadalcanal. It takes a part of the war that is so rich and has so many stories, but for your average person who comes through a public school system, they go, let's see, okay, we had Pearl Harbor, we had Midway, the Marines did some stuff on some vacation islands, then we nuked somebody. What brought you to that part of the Pacific War?
I was always drawn to the Pacific War because it was the Navy's war. There was something about the types of campaigns that were waged, the scale of distance, the nature of the action, the cool hardware that was coming to bear everywhere, as a kid, I was drawn to model shipbuilding, model aircraft building. And over time, it just kind of grew matured into deeper interest in the history. But it started out with, kind of this infatuation with naval hardware, I guess, and, really from a young age. The three books, the first of my books, Last Stand, covers 1944, when the tactical proficiency of the Navy was at a level where, even a small detachment of destroyers could perform in such a way as to turn back, an enemy force 30 times its size. The new book, Neptune's Inferno, covers Guadalcanal, where we're, making these first steps along this path. The body of the work, I guess, traces the evolution of the Navy as a fighting force during the years of its sternest test, which was the Pacific War. And I was just always drawn to that epic. So I guess we'll start there, yeah.
Yeah, I really enjoyed reading Neptune's Inferno, and I hope you'll forgive me if I say it reminds me a little of Douglas Southall Freeman's, some of his works about the early days of the war, and I don't know who wrote Grant Takes Command, but there is that atmosphere you've created of how we had to work through our senior leadership to sort out the warriors from the bureaucrats. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Guadalcanal was the first major offensive of the entire war, worldwide, and when it fell to the Navy and the Marines to lead it. The leadership of the Navy certainly was, a product of peacetime, and in this crucible at Guadalcanal, you see the Navy kind of earn its seasoning under fire, where commanders whose first and most ferocious instincts are reserved for the advancement of their own careers give way to people who are more battle-minded, if you will, up on the balls of their feet looking for a fight. They know what it takes to put ordnance on target first. And they work down this ethos of battle-mindedness through their command, so that everybody along the way ultimately is kind of working from the same page. It's about beating the Japs, and it took 6 months of nothing but defeat to get us there. 6 months from Pearl Harbor, you know, through this kind of hesitant victory at Coral Sea, then to Midway, to get us ready to go on the offensive. And Guadalcanal was an audacious enterprise, even with the great victory of Midway under our belts. Guadalcanal was launched on a shoestring with untested methods and doctrine, and indeed was met with just this unrelieved disaster in the Battle of Savo Island in the first 48 hours of the campaign. So from there, you know, who are the men who have the resilience and the fortitude to pick themselves up off the mat and lead our forces back into the breach, you know, hopefully to better result? And that's the story of the book.
I mean, that's a great lead into the question I wanted to ask, Jim, is when you look at that that timeline from Pearl Harbor to Guadalcanal, you had that pivotal moment at Midway, and then you look at the roll right into to Pearl Harbor, and in less than a year then the war start. Was there a battle on within the Navy leadership against those that wanted to grab the tiger by the tail with one hand and beat it with the other, and those that after Midway wanted to be a bit more cautious and deliberate in the next path forward?
You know, I don't think there was a dramatic clash of wills suggested by your question, where there were people of cautious mindset who eventually were overwhelmed by the fighters. It was more of an evolution. You know, the officer who was picked to be the commander-in-chief of our South Pacific forces at the outset of Operation Watchtower, as the Guadalcanal campaign was known, Admiral Gormley, it's just sort of a case study in leadership and the type of leadership that succeeds during peacetime versus the type of leadership that succeeds during wartime. Admiral Gormley was hailed as one of our preeminent naval strategists when he was chosen to lead the campaign. He was President Roosevelt had installed him in London to observe the Blitz, sort of as his personal eyes and ears. He reported directly to the president, CC'd Admiral Stark in the Navy Department. And he was over in London observing the British during their test against the Luftwaffe, and was reporting back to the main Navy about what he was seeing. He was reporting not only on the activities of the Germans, but also the nefarious doings of the Army Air Forces, U.S. Army Air Forces, that is, who he feared would get in the way of the Navy's efforts to have its own naval air arm. So it was almost a quasi-espionage role. It was diplomatic. He was whining and dining in the parlors of London with his British counterparts and reporting to Washington. He's airlifted in the space of 1 week from that all the way across the world and deposited in New Zealand and then to New Caledonia, where he's to set up headquarters for Operation Watchtower. I can scarcely imagine the man's vertigo. You know, not only from the setting of, you know, high diplomacy and high command, but to, you know, geographically and then psychologically into this place where he's going to be the head of a war fighting arm instead of basically this quasi espionage operation. And the, you know, for the world's first kind of test of trifibious warfare, where you've got marine elements who are heading out to land on an island supported by air and sea. And to have responsibility for all that, it must have been just an overwhelming transition. And, you know, with Admiral Gormley, you have a great admiral and strategist and a diplomat and, you know, sort of making it clear that he's in over his head for a variety of reasons, managing a combat front. And he's, you know, long story short, he's relieved of command in October, and in comes Admiral Halsey with a very different way of doing business. Admiral Gormley never went to the island of Guadalcanal. He never met with Vandegrift in the jungle. He never met the sergeants. He never toured Henderson Field. He was never with his task force commanders, you know, kind of up in the combat area. He was detached. He was overwhelmed in detail. He was... I think living in a constant state of chagrin for the shortcomings of his command in terms of supply and resources. And you know, eventually he comes to a place, and this was one of the revelations of my research, where Admiral Nimitz back at Pearl Harbor and Nimitz's staff actually come to the conclusion that Gormley, in the month before he's relieved of command, was actually having a nervous breakdown in the field. There have been a variety of speculations for why Gormley was relieved. He wasn't aggressive enough. He might have had some medical issue with a kidney or something like that. But Nimitz's actual thinking was that he was having a nervous breakdown. He was overwhelmed. He was not cut out for the rigors of wartime command. And it's no great indictment of his character or anything else. He was a very fine man, but he was in the wrong place. Admiral Nimitz handled him with incredible finesse. When Gormley returned to Pearl Harbor, he asked Admiral Nimitz, why was this necessary? Why did you relieve me? And Nimitz asked him, he said, well, you understand the stakes in the South Pacific. You understand what's going on down there. It's imperative that the U.S. Navy and America have the best man available to command that theater. Do you think you're the best man available? Do you think you're the best man available? Nimitz asked him. And his old friend had to admit, I don't think so. So having conceded that, Nimitz masterfully handled personnel at every turn. He handled egos. He handled, all kinds of situations with just incredible finesse, and this was one of them. And so he manages this transition, Nimitz does, a mid-campaign change of command from Gormley to Halsey. And with Halsey's entree, the morale of the fighting forces, Marine, Air, and Surface Navy alike, just takes a huge turn for the better. And from the middle of October on, you see a much more aggressive posture. And this is the point where, the Navy, the Surface Navy especially, kind of starts to develop its fighting esprit de corps. And a whole series of major engagements takes place from October through the end of the campaign and in February that puts in place that level of competence that will carry all the way through the Solomons and all the way, through the Central Pacific and all the way to Okinawa.
As you start writing this book, the latest book, and of course it occurs before the scenes you've set in Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailors, I was struck by your references to some of the limitations that Gormley had and Halsey had in turn with the number of aircraft carriers, the logistics train that wasn't capable of providing enough fuel for his fleet, the slowness, it seems, of getting additional assets out there to Guadalcanal, the aircraft, additional ships. And can you kind of just discuss that in the context of how the Navy worked through those issues, using Guadalcanal as a leaping point for what they knew, what they learned as they went along?
Yeah, this was the age of naval warfare and the age of steam, and it meant that I can't remember the source for this observation, but combat fleets were effectively chained to a post. Unlike in the era of fighting sail, when the men of war sailed with the wind, all of our combat ships were at the mercy of their radius, which was a function of their fuel supply. And so Admiral Nimitz had to reckon with the fact that shortages of fuel in the Pacific gave him the choice, essentially, of either operating his fast carrier task forces or operating his battleships, the old big boys of Task Force One. After Midway and Coral Sea and Midway, there was really no choice. So the carriers were it. And so Nimitz, conducted the entire South Pacific campaign on the strength of his carrier task forces. The battleship stayed home all through 1942. I'm referring, of course, to the older battleships. Eventually, the new, more fuel-efficient, fast battleships came into play very, very, very decisively in the South Pacific. But fuel was a constant limitation, and the Japanese had similar problems operating 7,000 miles from Kure Harbor, but they never seemed to grasp the centrality of those logistical issues, as evidenced by the fact that their submarines never seemed to go after our oilers. They were constantly hitting our cruisers and our carriers and combat shipping. The Japanese didn't have the same kind of sense of priority. But those priorities governed everything, and they powerfully affected the type of campaign that we were able to wage at Guadalcanal.
Yeah, I always found that amazing, the Japanese submarine force, especially when you consider the fact that the access to fuel was one of the major drivers for them to get into the war. The fact they couldn't translate that strategic concern into an operational mindset for their submarine force. I think I've read somewhere a lot of it had to do with you were less of a warrior if you went after unarmed ships as opposed to going after the warships, but really a short-sighted thing. And speaking of perspectives, with the Battle of Guadalcanal, depending upon who you talk to, there seems to be a distinct Navy narrative of the Battle of Guadalcanal and the Navy's performance and a Marine Corps narrative of the Navy's performance in Guadalcanal. In your research, did you pull out a distinct thread between the two? And if so, besides the usual twin brothers making comments at each other, was there a disconnect there between the Navy and the Marine Corps on what needed to be done?
Well, you know, since the war, the Marines have sort of owned the narrative of the Guadalcanal campaign. I think if you mention the name Guadalcanal to somebody, the first image they have is somebody like John Bassalone manning a machine gun nest in the jungle, fending off repeated Japanese assaults. And indeed, the Marines, you know, who held the perimeter around Henderson Field, performed brilliantly and heroically in that absolutely essential task. Henderson Field was the reason for the entire operation. It was that airfield that was of strategic importance. And so the Marines held that. They ventured out from that perimeter and assaulted the Japanese and waged just an incredible campaign of jungle warfare to include Marine raider operations, and their doctrine of defense was cemented and put to the test there. So the Marines have earned their right to claim Guadalcanal for their own. But what's also going on when you talk about this Marine-Navy rivalry in the context of Guadalcanal is, you know, this idea that the Navy, that far more than just beyond an instance of Marine gallantry, it was actually an instance of Navy cowardice. A lot of Marines will try to tell you that the Navy left them high and dry and got their tails kicked at Savo Island and, you know, fled from the combat area, leaving them alone. And that was true for about 10 days up until, an escort carrier shows up with about 20 F-4Fs and flies them off to Henderson Field. And, for those 10 days, the Marines were forced to watch their cargo ships pull out. Admiral Turner decided to withdraw the service force because the carriers were only providing, air cover through D-Day plus 2, I believe. And the Marines have never really gotten over their chagrin. But the fact is, you talk about the separate naval narrative. By the way, Admiral Halsey never distinguished the service branches. It was all South Pacific Fighting Force, as far as Halsey was concerned. By the end of the campaign, 3 sailors are killed at sea around Guadalcanal for every man who died on the island. The Navy threw itself into that breach, and without Navy guns and Navy blood, our ground forces on Guadalcanal would have been rolled up as surely as they were at Corregidor and Bataan. If the Navy had failed them, the Marines, would have been simply had no way to win. They would have had no supply, no reinforcement. The Japanese, had they had control of the seas at night and by day, had they knocked out the airfield, they would have, essentially been free to bring in reinforcements and supply. So, this idea that there are separate narratives is unfortunate. It's part and parcel of the fact that the Marines have historically been much better at telling their story than the Navy has. But in my mind, they're intertwined. One really doesn't win without the other, and there's plenty of credit to go around.
Eagle One.
As you get into your book, I mean, the first thing that starts after the U.S. Navy is this incredibly successful landing. We catch the Japanese by surprise. There aren't many Japanese on the island. And then it's almost immediately followed by the disaster at Savo Island, which, as you've portrayed it in the book, has a lot to do with the people in charge not really understanding how to use the tools they have. Can you discuss that a little bit?
Yeah, Savo Island was, with the greatest disaster our Navy suffered after Pearl Harbor. In fact, you could say it's worse than Pearl Harbor because the defeat at Savo Island was inflicted upon a combat, a surface task force that was in a combat theater and should have been on a combat footing. They're surprised. The cruiser forces defending the anchorage north of Guadalcanal were absolutely routed by the Japanese. Four Allied cruisers were sunk. 1,000 sailors were killed. And, you know, in the post-campaign analysis and inquest that the Navy launched, you know, the reasons were drawn out all too clear, and, you know, were made all too clear. The commanders in the area weren't essentially battle-minded. They were there were communications gaps between the scouting aircraft and the naval commanders. There was misplaced faith in radar. You know, we basically put a couple of destroyers on picket duty north of the patrol area along the anticipated line of the Japanese advance, counting on these destroyers' radar to kind of sweep the seas and call our attention to the approach of an enemy force. Well, the radar didn't perform anywhere nearly as well as people thought. The range was probably half to a third of what Admiral Turner thought it was. And, of course, the flat-out bad luck part of it was when the Japanese came through and Admiral Makawa takes his cruisers and comes steaming south at 25 knots. The two destroyers who are on picket duty are essentially moving back and forth on a patrol line in toward each other and then back away from each other to the extremes of the patrol line. The two destroyers were at the extremes of their patrol line when the Japanese came through. So essentially the pickets opened up a gate. The Japanese steamed right through it, and the radar wasn't long enough range to close the gap. And so the Japanese came through undetected. And so it was the culmination of a variety of failings, both in terms of technology, doctrine, and leadership. The Battle of Savo Island that ensues was a one-way route. The Japanese demonstrated their proficiency with the long lance torpedo, and we paid with the lives of 1,000 sailors as the Vincennes, Astoria, Quincy, and HMAS Canberra were all sunk in the space of about an hour and a half. I'm sorry, the Astoria and the Canberra went down the next morning, but the damage was swiftly inflicted by the Japanese, and it exposed all these areas where the Navy simply had to improve if it was to have any hope of winning the fight after dark. And that fight after dark was essential to winning the campaign.
The Chuck Nagel did a great book before 9/11 that kind of is a touchstone for a lot of people. It's very Army specific, but it's based upon his PhD dissertation about the Army as a learning institution, mostly focused on the British and the American experience. And with the imperfect understanding that the Navy had at the beginning of the war, of both its ability and those of the Japanese, you know, the Japanese long lance torpedo or the Japanese understanding of the U.S. Radar capabilities, which of the two institutions seem to be the best learning institution in the first part of the war? And what do you think made the difference in one side versus the other's ability to learn, adapt, and improve their abilities at sea?
You know, you're asking me to compare the U.S. Army to the U.S. Navy?
No. I'm sorry. The Japanese, just kind of like what Nagel did with the British and the Americans, if you look at the Japanese Navy and the American Navy as learning institutions in the first year and a half of the war, well, how did they compare on their ability to react to the changes and the realities of their opponent? And what do you think may have caused the difference between the two reactions?
Wow, what a great question. Let me start that by saying that, you know, that the story of the Navy at Guadalcanal is one of this learning curve. And I really wanted to be able to narrate the story as this steady progression of competence proceeding from Savo Island all the way through, you know, to the final Japanese withdrawal in February. But when you actually look at the battles, and there are five major surface actions that are the subject of the book, and two carrier actions. The five surface actions are sort of a frustrating case study, because you begin with the defeat at Savo Island, you proceed to Admiral Scott's victory at Cape Esperance, which was sort of a tactical level victory, nothing terribly important, but it was big for morale. Two nights later, after the victory at Cape Esperance, the Japanese come down and inflict the worst bombardment of a piece of land that any that any heavy artillery force has ever inflicted upon a piece of land. We're talking about the two battleships, Congo and Haruna, coming down with their 14-inch main batteries and plastering Henderson Field. So the fruit of victory, the fruit of Cape Esperance in the short run is negligible. Scott fails to stop this cataclysm from befalling Henderson Field. We have a month of sort of stalemate as the Japanese gather themselves for another push on Guadalcanal. And so Cape Esperance is the second battle. The third is the so-called cruiser night action conducted by Rear Admiral Daniel Callahan. Scott is riding second in command that night. And you have a Pyrrhic victory that is, you can argue the tactical proficiency of the U.S. side there. But it was a Pyrrhic victory that saved Henderson Field from a repeat of the October bombardment. So you have an instance of just sheer guts carrying the day, where Callahan throws an underweight force into a larger Japanese force at close range at night. And the victory, if you call it that, there was tremendous loss of life on both sides, sent such a shock through the Japanese force. All the way to Admiral Yamamoto at Truk, they didn't know that America had this willingness to sacrifice. They didn't know we had it in us to accept such losses in order to inflict such losses. We sank the Hiei. Japanese battleship Kirishima limps home to come back two nights later to face Willis Lee, the Washington, and the South Dakota in second Guadalcanal. Another great U.S. victory. So the fourth battle, Willis Lee inflicts the battleship night action following Callahan's Pyrrhic victory, is really a clean rout. And at that point, you'd like to say, well, we're learning. The Navy has absorbed the lessons of the defeats. We're marching along this path toward tactical proficiency. And, indeed, the tactical manuals are rewritten. There's new doctrine formulated, how task force commanders are supposed to use destroyers and cruisers. All of it goes back to Washington, comes back to the fleet in the way of new doctrine. And the problem is we have a constant change of personnel, new commanders coming in. You'd like to think the new commanders have read the textbooks and absorbed the lessons and know how to employ it. But Murphy's Law is a tyrant. And so the fifth and final surface action of Guadalcanal is the Battle of Tassafaronga, where, Admiral Wright achieves tactical surprise on a force of Japanese destroyers whose decks are loaded with supplies. They're being used as high-speed transports. And only to find, we have five cruisers and a whole assortment of destroyers, surprising six Japanese destroyers. The entire U.S. cruiser line draws on the lead destroyer, concentrates all of its gunfire, blows that destroyer out of the water. The five surviving Japanese react on a reflex that only long training and hard combat experience can give you. They turn broadside to the American line, release all their torpedoes, make smoke, and withdraw. They're fortunate they had the long-lance torpedo. Those torpedoes went forward, entered Wright's main body of his battle line, and just started blowing hulls out of the water. The New Orleans has her hull snapped off, the Minneapolis ditto, the Northampton sunk. On and on. So here you have, at the end of the campaign, this learning curve just crashes and burns. And so, and afterwards, the effectiveness, and here's why I say it's frustrating. Here's the reason to doubt that the U.S. Navy has learned all that much in the immediate months of this campaign. You'd like to think, well, the Japanese got lucky, but when you look at the action reports, it says time after time, American commanders were saying it's not possible to account for how Japanese torpedoes were able to hit us at this range. We assumed Japanese submarines were present. After all these months of action, we still don't know about the long-lance torpedo. And so it's important not to apply too much hindsight to the story of the war. It's important to understand the situation that commanders faced in the moment, because that's the only fair way to evaluate somebody. They didn't know about the Japanese long lance, really. There are those who did. Foremost among them, the officers and men of the USS Houston, lost in March of 1942. They learned about the long lance the hard way, but as prisoners of the Japanese, they weren't in a position to tell anybody about it. So, you know, yeah, the Navy's learning, but it's a messy process. It's filled with setbacks and loop-de-loops and all kinds of things that get in the way of a nice, clean story of an education in the ways of war.
Yeah, I was impressed by the fact that, and I'm going to ask a biographical question here, somewhere in the midst of my rambling, but you got one of the key lessons of naval warfare, which Captain Wayne Hughes has written about, which is fire effectively first. And and you've repeated that in the book, that it was stunning to me how many times we had the ability to cross the T or cap the T of the enemy force, how many times where Callahan took his fleet right into the middle of the Japanese mission, and he may have had some reason for doing that, but we waited to fire until the range was 4,000, 5,000 yards or less. It just seemed really odd to me. But in your background, you didn't start out as a naval warfare specialist, if I'm not mistaken.
No, not at all. I never served a day in uniform. I guess that makes me doubly hesitant to judge men who served in uniform and put themselves in harm's way. I'm hesitant ever to do that. I try to retain that kind of humility of, you know, this recognition that anybody who writes about history, especially somebody who gets a hold of all the documents and kind of becomes an expert in what happens at any given moment, that you have this incredible advantage of hindsight, and it's extremely unfair to apply that advantage to any given historical figure. You know, you have to be careful how you assess somebody's decisions. Admiral Callahan's a great example. You know, when I was doing my research and I'm going through the action reports and I'm compiling the data from, say, the action report of the USS Helena alongside the action report of the van destroyers that were, you know, about 2-3 miles ahead of the Helena, Admiral Callahan in the San Francisco is querying his destroyers for what they see. What you got now? He's got a tactical radio set that's got a single channel, and every time he asks a question, nobody else can get through to him. And so he's constantly querying his destroyers, what do you see now? Well, the Helena is trying to tell him. You know, a few thousand yards astern, the Helena's got an SG radar set, you know, enemy bearing 319, range, you know, 32,000 yards. How much better could you hope to have? And so it's easy to say, you know, well, Callahan didn't avail himself of any of this crucial data. Had he only known the enemy was, you know, on this bearing at this range, he could have opened up and achieved surprise and landed first salvo hits. And, you know, it's easy to crucify a guy based on that until you realize, based on, you know, further research, you learn that, well, Callahan knew what he faced that night. He knew he had cruisers going up against battleships. You know, a huge disadvantage, 14-inch, for, you know, Callahan's got 8-inch cruisers against 14-inch Japanese battleships. We don't know what his tactical plan was. He didn't put it in writing, and, of course, he doesn't survive the action to tell us afterwards. But it does come to light that he knew what he faced, and it's entirely possible that he knew his only chance lay in getting in close. You know, closing the point, you know, holding off opening fire until he was in close where the Japanese hadn't had the opportunity to guide their torpedo fire based on our muzzle flashes, say. You know, there are a lot of things, a lot of advantages that accrue to a cruiser force getting in close amidst battleships. And so, you know, he seems to have pulled it off. We don't know if that's what he intended, but I'm most careful about just trying to lay the situation. To lay out the situation as it was known in the moment, informing the reader after the fact or even along the way about what we knew afterwards is helpful so that, you know, you can write a responsible account. But, you know, I'm always cautious about, you know, dropping that hammer of judgment on somebody based on information that comes after the fact.
Yeah, it's funny. You talk about lessons that people should remember, but they always forget. One of the best things I learned as an ensign, I had a commanding officer tell me, shut up, you talk too much on the radio. And it's true, you just could talk too much on the radio. One of the best flag officers ever worked for is Cutler Dawson, and he was notorious or famous, depending upon your point of view, is whatever you gave him, it would come back about 50% the size that you sent it there. It's brevity is all important. When the we look at the battles, we look at we got the maps, we got the little ships moving around, and naval warfare in many respects can be a very impersonal thing. But when you look at the battle reports from the USS San Francisco, CA-38, She took 45 hits, most of which were 6-inch and 8-inch rounds between the 12th and the 13th of November of 42. Two of the hits that she took were from 14-inch battleship rounds. She went into the dry dock in San Francisco, I believe, on the 11th of December 42, and all that damage was repaired, and she was underway again and headed back to Westpac on 28 February 43, basically a 100-day turnaround. In your research, and I know you've also, going back to the USS Houston, you've been in personal contact with some of the individuals involved in these battles. What are some of the sailor-level stories, whether it's tactical or damage control, that really stick in your mind that you've gone through in your research?
You know, that's a great question, too, because, you know, I'm most interested in the human experience of all this. I'm interested in the problems that commanders face as they devise strategies and task force plans and pursue different objectives. I'm interested in how captains train their crews and prepare them for battle. And I'm interested in the experience of the ordinary blue jacket himself. And so it's this human perspective that is so crucial to writing an accessible account, an account that's going to be meaningful to a reader who's not a naval professional. The interviews that I did for this book were, the direct interviews were fewer in number than they were for Last Stand. And this reflects the fact that right now there are about half the number of World War II veterans surviving that we had in 2003. We lost 50%. I think we're down to about 1.7 million veterans left. Back in 2003, 2002, when I was interviewing Last Stand, you know, the reunion events were in full swing. All the ship reunions were still going on. You can go to Tucson or Tulsa or Austin or Washington and sit down with the guys, you know, in their company, which is crucial. One-on-one's great, but I really enjoy seeing guys talking with each other, because if you watch them and the way they interact with each other, you can pick up something of kind of the emotional tenor of what took place and what was significant and what wasn't significant, what's controversial, what's not controversial. And, you know, having that experience, you can then go back to them individually and follow up and say, I noticed when you were talking to Mr. Smith, he seemed to think this. What do you think? And that's how you get into the heart of the matter. With Neptune's Inferno, I didn't have the benefit of quite as many ship reunions. There were a few. The last reunion of the USS New Orleans took place in Austin shortly before I was finished with my research, and I was able to sit down with men who talked about that ship's experience in the Battle of Tassafaronga. The New Orleans was hit by a torpedo. She lost 150 feet of her bow forward of turret 2 to a long lance. There was a guy at that reunion who was in the radio in the communications department. He was a radioman. He was in main radio, and he talked about how he was still in touch with a radioman or a guy on the radio in the turret stock of turret number 1 as it sank. That kind of thing doesn't show up in an action report. You can imagine the tragedy of that ship. It's amazing they saved that ship given the extent of her damage. But the fact that, you know, there were men who went down in those toxic waters to dog down hatches, you know, right at the place where the bulkhead frame where the ship broke, to close off hatches and to, you know, do various things in the context of damage control that saved the ship. To get a personal perspective on that was just invaluable. And so, you know, this idea that there were 150 doomed men in the forward part of the ship sinking to their death, and they're still on the radio with main radio, I mean, that is so indelibly poignant to me. It's just jaw-dropping. So little moments like that, I think. There was a wonderful veteran I interviewed from the USS San Francisco. You mentioned CA-38. Eugene Tarrant was the captain's cook. He was reported directly to Casson Young, and was with Admiral Callahan in the lead up to the battle of November 13th. Mr. Tarrant, you know, was actually a witness to some conversations that Admiral Callahan had with his staff about knowing full well, based on air search, what they were going up against that night. and saying that this is suicide, but we have to do it. Mr. Tarrant was, you know, he's an African American man. He had gone as far as he could go in the Navy. He was, you know, captain's cook. If you're in the S Division, that's as far as you went in the World War II era Navy. It's funny, today his shipmates call him the Admiral because he is so smart and he is so sharp and he is so widely respected for his leadership that none of them has any doubt that he would have been their commanding officer at the very least had he been in the modern era Navy. So it was a privilege to come to know these men. I was out in San Francisco this past Memorial Day where at Land's End they've got a, you mentioned the San Francisco coming back to dry dock in December. They removed a large piece of her, you know, pilot house shield, which was riddled by Japanese gunfire. And they've got that big piece of half-inch thick steel set up at Land's End in San Francisco as a memorial to that ship. And it's just a beautiful, sight. We had 500 people at Memorial Day up there. I got to say a few words to them all, and it was truly an honor. So the groups are still convening, but they are fewer in number, and you know, any work that I do going forward in World War II will have to be based, I think, on documents more than living contact, and I'll miss these days when they're gone. I really will.
Yeah, I think one of the terrific things about your books is the interviews with the and the stories that are there told by the people who went through the situation. And some of it is so horrific. I mean, we tend to think of land as being, because it's portrayed more often on in movies and television, as being horrific. But in your book, this latest book, you talk about the body parts sweep that had to be conducted on board these ships, and usually done by senior enlisted personnel as they went around trying to find various components. Why was that the case? And how does that fit into the scheme of war? I mean, you know, you lose 900 men in a single ship. We don't do that in land battles very often.
No, well, you know, a body part sweep was something I didn't know existed until I talked to Chief Johnny Johnson from the USS San Francisco. He talked about the morning after. You know, we've talked briefly today about that cataclysmic battle Admiral Callahan waged on November 13th. Well, the sun rises after that terrible night battle, and the crew has to reckon with what's become of their ship. The San Francisco was limping south, you know, for Espirito Santo, and topside, the Japanese had been firing bombardment ammunition at the ship, which was wonderful for her watertight integrity and for her hull structure. I don't think she was hit by a single armor-piercing round, or at least not hit below the waterline. But the detonation of all this bombardment ammunition meant that, you know, there was anybody in a topside station was exposed to airbursts, and her decks were an abattoir. And so the crew was called topside, and they were to, you know, scrub down steel that had been shot through with, you know, blood and gore. They were to bag up body parts and throw them over the side, give people burials as they could. And it was one of the most vivid traumas that anybody on that ship, which collected 17 battle stars throughout the rest of the war, nobody in the San Francisco who was aboard in 1942 ever forgot Friday the 13th and the morning that followed when they had to clean up the ship of their 105 odd killed in action. Admiral Halsey came aboard at Espirito Santo, saluted the crew, passed out decorations, and there was a whiff of blood in the air as he did so. It was just a ghastly moment. It's easy, you know, we all relate to, based on what we see in the movies, we all understand the horrors of land warfare. Civilians, you know, will witness the immediate aftermath of a battle in a village in France, say, or, you know, even a battle on an island where there are civilians. But the fighting at sea is kind of remote, and its only witnesses are the crews on the ships that get hit. We saw this in HBO's The Pacific. At the outset, there's a portrayal of John Bassalone and his buddies watching the screening force in the Battle of Savo Island, you know, engaging the Japanese. And it's just basically, you know, flashes of light in the water. There's no telling what's going on out there. And so the crew, you know, just it's a ship is a unique, the sea is a unique battlefield, and that there's very little evidence of what took place the morning after, but the remains left on the ship were to be reckoned with. And for morale, you know, they had to clean it up as soon as possible.
You know, your description really brought to heart one of my hobby horses. The good part is I get real excited when I have guests like you on. But the darker side of my hobby horse is the fact that it really, really frustrates me. The state of the knowledge and the study of history in the Navy, because you know, you can go back to descriptions of how the Romans fought with their galleys. You can go the description you just gave of a battle in World War II, the Falkland Islands, or even the USS Stark, what happened with her, and the essentials of having enough people on board that can survive hits, be able to save the ship, and get the ship moving forward and prevent further death. And it is the study of that history in depth, not the little models moving across the map, but the personal story and what it takes to fight a ship and to fight hurt. There are lessons that are very easily forgotten by people who only have a superficial understanding of their own history. And when I look at other services, I'll look at the Marine Corps. General Mattis is a huge advocate of reading and books and learning, because he knows that makes a better combat leader, because it adds depth and detail to the decisions that they make going forward. And I'm hoping here, because I don't know for sure, but I assume in the course of writing these books, you've had a chance to talk with active duty sailors and perhaps some of our leadership. When you look at Navy uniformed leadership, do you see a couple of senior leaders come to mind that you feel are real enthusiasts and advocates for reading and the study of history from a professional perspective, if not recreationally?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question. I was very fortunate that Last Stand, the first of my three books, was picked up for the Navy Professional Reading Program. And the feedback I've had from the fleet has actually been really, really gratifying. I was in Norfolk back in May for a book event. I did a book signing at the Exchange and spoke to the Surface Navy Association, Hampton Roads, and the Cruiser Sailors Association. And at several of those events, we had lieutenant commanders or commanders who were skippers of destroyers, frigates or cruisers, who came with their entire wardroom to the talk. And I was just thunderstruck by that fact that they would want to hear what I had to say. Maybe it's a testimony to how poor a job people have done commemorating this history that they have to look to me for this, to reconnect with this heritage. But there they were, and I was humbled and honored. While I was in Norfolk, I was able to meet with Admiral Harvey, the 4-star commander of Fleet Forces Command. He's a big advocate of history. Not only that, he's very much in touch with the sailors of his command. He has a blog. You guys probably have read his blog. And he's a big advocate of the relevance and the essentiality of this history. So I'm really comforted that the active duty fleet that I've been in touch with really cares about this stuff, and that this legacy is really having an effect on how they do their business.
One of the other things that I appreciate about your books is that you take a really strong look at the decisions that have to be made by people in times of great stress. So you you discuss the decision of the CEO of one of the ships who had to sail past the Juno gets blown up by a long lance torpedo or two, and he has to sail through the debris field where there may or may not be alive. He can't stop. He later is chastised by Halsey for that. Can you kind of discuss that and tie that if you can to the other decision? Every point in this book, you hit a decision that some commander had to make that had lingering effects as you go along, from the decision of the Japanese to turn around at various times to a whole bunch of other things. I mean, it's a fascinating study in the choices that you have to make in a combat situation.
In combat, good people are put in situations where there's simply no win. And the example you mentioned was Captain Hoover, Gilbert Gibb Hoover of the Helena. After the cruiser night action November 13th, he was the senior officer afloat in what's left of Callahan's task force. And his force on route to Espirito Santo comes under submarine attack. The Japanese submarine fires into his column, hits the USS Juno, CL-52, bringing a secondary explosion of her magazine. 680-foot-long cruiser goes off like a firecracker, basically. it's not evident to anybody that there are any survivors. The catastrophe was that complete. Hoover was good friends with her captain, Lyman Swenson, and he wrestled with the question of whether he should stop and look for survivors. He had to bear in mind that he had damaged ships in his column. The San Francisco was with him. The Sterrett destroyer had been hammered. There were, you know, corpsmen and doctors at work on wounded, and he had to get his ships back to base. Moreover, there was an enemy submarine still out there, so if he stopped engines and circled to look for survivors, and he would have put his entire task force in jeopardy. So he makes the impossible decision to leave behind survivors of the Juno, such as they may be, and head back to base. Well, 5 days later, when the PBYs and the transport ships finally sweep the seas and find the last guy from the Helena, there are 10 men out of that 700-man crew who are survivors. Admiral Halsey was incensed. He was incensed from the get-go. As soon as Hoover pulled into Espirito Santo, Halsey was on him about, you know, where's the Juno and why didn't you stop to look for survivors? And his temper flared. He came down on Hoover. He endorsed the action report of Hoover along with a memo questioning his judgment, and that essentially ended the seagoing career of one of our greatest fighting captains of the war. Hoover would receive his third Navy Cross for his conduct of the Helena in two major actions at Guadalcanal. He'd received, you know, Navy Cross from Coral Sea as a destroyer division commander, and he'd received one, I think, for Cape Esperance. And it was just a vast tragedy and a vast injustice to be, you know, to have a guy of his caliber set aside for the remainder of the war because of this, you know, kind of this unfair application of judgment. But, again, this is what warfare does to people. You put good people in harm's way. You give commanders impossible decisions under fire where going left is, you know, catastrophic and going right is catastrophic. And yet somehow we expect them to go through the middle somehow and come out the other end with a victory. You know, it in many cases it simply can't happen. And Guadalcanal was a, you know, there was instance after instance of this. Captain Bodie of the Chicago, you know, was another example from the Battle of Savo Island, just very briefly. He was put temporarily in command of the cruiser screening the transport anchorage when Admiral McAuliffe sweeps through and, you know, raising hell with the cruiser screen. And Bodie became kind of confused, and he conned the Chicago to the west when the battle was flowing east astern of him, and took the Chicago essentially out of the fight. After the campaign was over, Admiral Hepburn comes out of retirement, the great four-star admiral, to conduct his inquest. And Hepburn interrogates all the commanders of the campaign looking for culpability, looking for kind of actionable culpability for the fiasco of Savo Island. And Navy politics being what they are, Hepburn places blame right where it belongs, I guess, in the eyes of the command, at the 06 level. And so Bodie's career is flushed, and he's assigned to command Naval Station Panama Canal. And his solution to this vast kind of indignity is to put a bullet through his head in April of 1943. And so, you know, Bodie was another guy. He was a captain. He was headed for flag rank. He was a star until the shooting started, and until the impossible situation comes. You know, impossible situations from which it's impossible to, you know, save one's reputation in some cases. And you know, I'm sympathetic to everybody who's caught up in this vortex, and it's the drama of it all and the tragedy of it all that I hope to elucidate in my writing.
Yeah, I wish you had written your books about 20 years earlier, because you've really put together some great vignettes about leadership and decisions that I would love to have read as an ensign. So all our readers out there that are midshipmen and junior officers who haven't grabbed your books already should. I wanted to go back for a quick moment. Speaking of leadership, you talked about the changeover from Gormley to Halsey and the effect that had on the morale and the battle-mindedness of the fleet. In your research, have you come across a common thread that can build battle-mindedness in a combat force and its leaders that may not have been present? How do you imbue your leaders with that battle-mindedness and the morale that comes with it?
you know, based on the people I've talked to, and a great eyewitness to a lot of this stuff was a veteran of the USS Atlanta, lost in the Battle of Friday the 13th. His name was Robert Graff. He was a signal officer on that ship, and he knew Admiral Scott. He knew Admiral Mustin, Lloyd Mustin, the ship's assistant gunnery officer, all these guys who kind of rose to the top after the shooting started. And Mr. Graff basically explained to me that, you know, being in the presence of somebody who had a battle-minded approach, who was aggressive, it was almost on a pheromonal level when you're in the presence of a person like that. People wonder, you know, is a great leader born or is he made? Is a great writer born or is he made? What have you? Baseball player? I think warfighter, naval warfighter, it's the same kind of thing. Is he born or is he made? And it seems to be an attitude as much as anything else. It was Admiral Halsey's attitude and his reputation and the things he would say that would be carried in the radio or in the newspaper or in the magazine covers that would kind of carry an attitude with it that inspired people. It wasn't that we have to perform this 6-point checklist to become battle-minded. Sure, there were things you could do to ensure that your ship at general quarters would be able to return fire quickly. But the ability to inspire the crew to return fire with a vengeance and to be burning to do it and to use that burn to, you know, kind of take it down another level, say the petty officer to the sailor, to show them what they had to do to fire faster and more effectively, to make them burn with the motivation and desire to do it. All that was on this very intangible personal level of psychology and pheromones and balls. That's what Mr. Graff said about Scott. He said Scott had balls. You can just kind of tell, you know, dealing with somebody like that. I don't know if you have to censor this radio show, but
no.
I mean that's what it comes down to. We need the 6-second delay here, but you kind of knew viscerally when you were in the presence of somebody who was a fighter.
Yeah, Mattis is like that. Eagle One.
Jim, this has been great, and I want to know what we have to look forward from you next. Are you working on something new, or you're going to take a short hiatus or what?
Well, you know, I wear a couple of different hats in the book publishing business. The writing has been something I've done in the last 10 years. I work as a literary agent as well. Barrett Tillman, the naval aviation historian, has an absolutely fantastic biography of the USS Enterprise, CV-6. Coming out in February. I've helped him with that. I've been involved with his book and helped him get it published. So, you know, I've been kind of clearing the palette, if you will, just kind of throwing myself into my agency side work. And as far as writing goes, my next project is actually going to bring me more into the current era, special operations and that kind of thing. So, you know, it's there are a lot of wonderful stories to be told, and I'm staying after it.
Well, Jim, I tell you what, I'll pop your people an email about Mr. Tillman's book on CV6. I think that would be a subject, again, a lot of people would like to talk about. Thank you so much. I'm just parallel Eagle One. Really enjoyed having you on today. Thank you very much for taking time this day to be with us.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
And thanks, everybody, for joining us live. And those who have come in the chat room, hope to see you next week. Until then, have a great Navy day.